Good morning. Is my microphone on? No, because I haven't pressed the button. Is my microphone on? Yeah, there we go. Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Stiles, you say. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Stiles.
That's right, very good. So, who gets your vote? And I'm not talking about Brexit versus the EU. I'm not talking about Donald and Hillary. I'm not talking about The Apprentice or I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, or X Factor, or any other game show on TV. I'm talking about the issue of loyalty. Who is the person? What is the organisation? What is the system? What is the thing, the idea, the whatever, to whom you give your ultimate loyalty? Who is it that, when they play the tune, you dance to their music? Now, that is the question that lies behind the book of Daniel. Who rules? Who is boss? Who calls the shots? Not just in general terms, but personally, for you. Who calls the shots for you? Now, because Daniel is in the Bible, you won't be surprised to know that the right answer to the question is that God rules, but it's more complicated than that. There are lots of ways of summarising the storyline of the Bible, because you're doing the overview. I'm sure you know that the Bible is not just a collection of bits and bobs, odd stories that are kind of sewn together and you can see the joins. It's not just a shelf full of different books where one novel has no relation to the novel further along the shelf, except they're in alphabetical order, or in my daughter's case, in colour-coded order of books. It's a single story. That is what the Bible is. But it's not about you. Now, here's one way of summarising the single story that is the Bible, and that is to see that it is about two cities, the two cities being Jerusalem and Babylon. Jerusalem is God's holy city. It's where God's people belong. And if we want to see it, we need to look not down south, not to the eastern end of the Med, but up. We need to look up to the Jerusalem that is not here yet, but is coming. The home for God's people, the eternal home, the new home that will come down out of heaven from God, to which all of God's people belong. The home that God is going to take us to. And the other city of the Bible story is Babylon, which is where everybody lives. A city that represents human depravity. It's a fitting place for the people who've kicked God into touch. The thing is that Babylon is the city where God's people are at the moment. God's people live here in Babylon, in exile, far from the new Jerusalem. Until that Jerusalem comes down, we are living in Babylon. We're aliens and strangers here because we can't wait to get home, but here is where we are. People of Jerusalem living in Babylon. Now, of course, as soon as I say that, that's not so different from us, is it? In London. God's people, far from our heavenly home, living like exiles, strangers, aliens. We belong in Jerusalem, but we live in Babylon, in a city that largely doesn't acknowledge God. And that is where the question of loyalty comes in. We live in London, we live in Babylon, but if you're a Christian, you belong in Jerusalem. And the question is, to whom do you owe the greater loyalty? Babylon is all around us. Jerusalem is far away in the future. And because it's far away in the future, it currently is a bit vague compared to Babylon that you can touch and see and feel, and it's all around us. Jerusalem, we know, is much more important than Babylon, but at the moment it doesn't seem so real. It's far away. So, living here in Babylon, to whom do you owe your loyalty? When they play the tune, to which tune will you dance? Which city are you most loyal to? Now, this is why Daniel is such a great book to read. It's going to do you loads of good this weekend. It's going to do me loads of good this weekend. I know it is, because God wrote it for us. So it's going to help us. An old preacher friend of mine once said that the Bible is written to convince us that God is in charge because we don't really believe that he is. And one of the reasons we don't believe it is, well, we'll try this for a first statement. You'll see, by the way, there's an outline of where we're going in the booklets if you want to use those as a place to make notes. God rules when his people are in chains. Now, that is a surprising statement because the chains seem to deny the rule. Surely, if God rules, then his people should too. If God is on our side, surely we should be not in chains, but ruling alongside him. I mean, just look at the church in Britain, people say. It's a joke, isn't it? The church tells you all there is to say about their God. God is like a bumbling Church of England clergyman. He's like Rowan Atkinson in Four Weddings and a Funeral. Can't even get out the name of the Holy Trinity without stumbling over it. Many people would say you could write God off just because of what the church is like. But the book of Daniel says that the power of God is not to be measured by the power that his people wield. The influence of God isn't dependent on the influence of Christians. No, God rules even when his people are in chains. Jerusalem is the reality even when Babylon seems to be very, very real all around us. Look down to verses 1 and 2. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hands with some of the vessels of the house of his God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels that are from the house of God into the house, the treasury of his God. Now, it's very easy to read those verses, but actually that is a crisis of everything that the nation stood for, everything that the city of Jerusalem on earth stood for. For God has made his people, the Jews, he's made them his special people. He's made them promises 1,400 years earlier that they'd be a great nation in a prosperous land enjoying his blessing. And now look again, verse 1, the land's been invaded. Verses 3 and 4, the next bit that I didn't read, the people have been carried off. And it's going to get worse. Not only this handful of people in verses 3 and 4, the kind of super guys of the nation get carried off, but the whole nation gets deported. The city is going to be destroyed. The people who belong in Jerusalem are now carted off to the land of Babylon. And this is a crisis moment. How can you say God rules when his people are in chains? How can it be that God rules? How can he be in charge if his promises fail, obviously fail like this? If the jackboot of a tyrant regime like Babylon can just march in without so much as a by your leave and tread all over the people who are supposed to be God's special people and stamp out the promises of God, how can you say that God is in charge? And the striking answer is verse 2. And the first three words of that, God did it. God delivered them. God handed them over. The Lord gave the king of Judah into the hand of the king of Babylon. In other words, this isn't something that happened despite God, you know, against his better judgment. He was ruling no less when his people were in chains. He's just as much in charge then as when they were conquering their enemies. It's not that God somehow rules more if things are going swimmingly and rules less when we look around us and think things are going badly. And the reason is because this exile is exactly what God said he was going to do. For years and years, the promises that God had made had always included this warning. Things would go well for the nation if it was loyal to God. Things would go badly for the nation if they wandered from him. And the worst possible bad thing that could happen is that God's people would be taken out of the place of his blessing and dumped in Babylon. And God had kept sending warnings. The nation had ignored them. We prayed earlier that we'd have soft hearts. The nation had hard hearts. They That means they heard what God said and did nothing about it. They got worse and worse. God's messengers kept coming and saying, come back, turn around. Can you not see where you're headed? It's disastrous. Come back. But they didn't. And now what had been unthinkable had happened. God's people were in chains. God gave Jehoiakim into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. And that terrible thing, I wanted to get you to feel this, that terrible thing, what felt like the bottom falling out of your world. Everything is upturned. Everything that you clung to, the promise of God, that absolute disaster, that is God keeping his promises. That's exactly why they'd gone into exile, because God still rules. God rules when his people are in chains. Do you think that God is less in charge when something bad happens to you? And the answer is we do, don't we? You know, some relationship that you're clinging to falls apart and there's bad feeling and hurt. Or your plans for this stage of your life, your next stage of your life, whatever you were thinking was going to be, that kind of collapses for some reason. Or your computer crashes and you lose all this morning's work. I mean, it honestly can be something as trivial as that. And we're so cross with God. Why did you let this happen? It can be something very tiny in the big scheme of things. It feels big to us and we think that God has failed us. And then, of course, when things are going swimmingly, when everything's sunny, we think God is very powerful. How good God is to us. We're so shallow, aren't we? God turns his rule off and on like a tap. Ridiculous. God rules, full stop. If things go badly for us, that's not because God has stopped ruling. As if God's power has been overcome by something more powerful than him. It's not because he's lost some of his magic superpowers. And if things go well for us, it's not as if God has suddenly regained it all again. God rules when his people are in chains. Second thing, God rules when a tyrant is in charge. Let's look to the next bit, verse 3. The king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance, skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding and learning, and competent stands in the king's palace, and to teach them literature and language of the Chaldeans. And the king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and the wine that he drank. They were to be educated for 3 years, and at that time they were to stand before the king, in other words, enter the king's service. Now, if we ask what's going on, obviously there's some clever political manoeuvring going on here, isn't there? You indoctrinate the potential leaders at undergraduate level. You bring those who would be the up-and-coming guys of the nation you've conquered, and you put them through your educational system, your private university. You teach them all things Babylonian in Trump University, and you mould these potential rebels into dependents. But I wonder if there's a greater significance as well going on here. It's not just one powerful nation trying to influence the leaders of another nation. The greatest significance here is that you've got an attempt to order the world so that Nebuchadnezzar is established as the superpower. You see, what he's imposing is a unity. One language, one social policy, one common bond of education. Why? We all know the same fairy tales, the same idioms, the same stories, the same literature, the same philosophy. We share it all. And verses 6 and 7, they're given new names as well, imposing a new identity, a new relationship to Babylon and her gods. I put all this up there. You don't need to write it all down. You can find it from a book. But all the names that these four guys that are given as examples to us. Their names all represented some kind of relationship with Israel's God, and the new names that they're given here in verse 7 are names that establish a link to Babylon's gods. It's this new identity. This is an attempt to reorder the world with Nebuchadnezzar at the center. It's a challenge, therefore, to God, isn't it? What you've got here is somebody opposing God. There are kind of modern examples of that as well, aren't they? I was reading an article the other day about the alleged policy that there is in some US departments, not just since Trump, but going back further than that, to establish a Pax Americana all around the world, like a kind of Roman peace, like a Roman Empire, to establish American rule all over the world. What about the idea of a worldwide caliphate, a single one world government that some Muslim organizations, the more extremist Muslim groups, want to impose? The same idea, a united political organization to challenge and defeat all others. That seems to be what's going on here, and that is why it is so dramatic to be told that God is still ruling. That he is still ruling as much as ever, when this anti-God tyrant is usurping the throne. Isn't that extraordinary? You've got somebody saying, I am going to be center of this world. And the message of Daniel is God still rules when this Nebuchadnezzar is doing that. Look down to verse 9. Because Daniel and his friends in verse 9 decide that they're not going to eat the royal food and wine in verse 8. And God had affected this official to show favor to Daniel. You see what it says at the beginning of 9? God gave Daniel favor in the sight of this chief. See how that verse is worded? God makes it happen. That Daniel and his friends receive favor. Look at verse 17. Again, the same phrase. God gave to these four youths learning and skill, understanding and knowledge, even in pagan literature and culture. Notice again, it's God who gave it to them. God gave them this. And I take it that what verse 9 and verse 17 say explicitly about God gave that, that is, I assume, is happening in verse 15 as well. We're to take that as being God at work just as much, that they become fat on their vegetables and water. And good-looking boys. There's stuff in the paper every week, isn't there, about diet. If we eat less, we'll live longer. Which kind of assumes we do want to live longer. I suppose some people do. Maybe this simpler diet was healthy, and maybe that would scientifically explain verse 15. That's why they were healthy, because they lived on a healthier diet. But the theme of the chapter is that God has done this as well. God rules in that. So just get that. Put these things together. God rules so that a government official shows favor. God rules when we are healthy and get plump. God rules when we pass exams at a secular university in secular studies. In other words, God's sovereign rule extends to all this and more. His rule isn't limited. It's not just about what we might call religious activities. That's the kind of neat little box we like to put God in, don't we? God rules in that little bit of life, the religious bit. No, God rules in all of those things as well. So tonight, when you comb your hair, and I can see that some of you should do that tonight. Tonight, when you comb your hair and you notice hairs on your comb, the Bible says that God knows how many hairs there are on your comb, and also how many hairs are left in your head, which for some of us is not that many, but also that the hairs have only gone from your head to the comb on his say-so. God rules over that. even your hair combing routines. So this anti-God pagan was not outside the rule of God. God was still on the throne when somebody else was on the throne. God was still ruling when somebody else tried to usurp his place and say, no, I rule. God was still the center of the universe when another man comes along and says, I will order the world around me and I will be central. So I take it it's just as true with our 90-year-old queen. God still rules. I take it it's just as true with Donald Trump. God still rules. With so-called Islamic State and their leaders? Yes. In fact, there's no bit of this world you could point to and say, there's somewhere where God doesn't rule. He rules in all of those things, even with those things. One example of this that's often quoted is back into the 1950s, when Christian ministries were all booted out of China. My dad thought that God had called him to go as a missionary to China, so this story's got particular resonance for our family. And what happened in the 1950s is that the China Inland Mission, which had been established at the end of the 19th century by Hudson Taylor, there we go, wrong way. Sorry, I pressed the wrong button then. There we go. That the Maoist authorities expelled all the Western missionaries in the 1950s. And this is even before my time, but for all of our time, this sent shockwaves through the Christian world in the West. That in this mighty nation, all of the Christian influence had been expelled. How could that happen? You know, if you believe in a God who wants mission, and if you believe in a God who is control, how could God allow it? And that's a question that all the Christians in the West were asking. Of course, now we see it differently, because Christian revival was going on in China all the time that was going on. If you compare the average annual growth rate, it was a revival going on in the church in China. So I saw a pastor on BBC2's Newsnight a few years ago who said that he thought within his lifetime China could become a Christian nation. That's extraordinary. But I mean, whether or not we get that happy ending, God was still ruling, is still ruling. In Afghanistan, over 99% of the country are Muslim. There's a tiny handful of Christians virtually wiped out. Christian evangelism is prevented in Afghanistan. God rules that. I was in Zanzibar a couple of years ago. I met a secret believer. I'm going to tell you his story a bit later on. But he's living in under an oppressive regime in fear for his life. But he's still believing. Church is still there. People are becoming Christians. Despite the most militant Muslim authorities seeking to stamp it out. When God's people are in chains, when a wicked, tyrannical regime is in charge, that isn't evidence of a world out of control. This is God ruling. And the third thing, God rules and his people will too. And I'm thinking about the very last verse of the chapter, which says that Daniel was there in the court, serving before the king, until the first year of King Cyrus. Now that is a crushing statement. Because here is Nebuchadnezzar, the tyrant, establishing world rule, making himself the world ruler. He's enforcing world domination with him at the center. And yet, according to verse 21, Daniel outlasted him and his son's reign that followed him as king of Babylon. And in fact, his entire dynasty, the entire Babylonian empire would pass and fall away. And the next empire, the Persian empire that King Cyrus was king of, that would come. And Daniel would carry on there outlasting the world's superpower. Now, the point to learn here is not that Christians will always keep their jobs, will always do well, will always outlast their boss. Verse 21 is just saying that's what happened here. But it is a picture of a greater truth that the rest of the book will enlarge, that God's people will turn out to be the winning side. And it's very interesting as you zip through Daniel. In fact, just come with me. Just look how each chapter ends. You've got that verse at the end of chapter 1. Look at the end of chapter 2, verse 48. Same idea. The king gave Daniel high honours, many gifts, made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon, chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. Daniel made a request to the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. Daniel remained at the king's court. Look at the end of chapter 3. The king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. Chapter 4 and 5 is slightly different, but look at the end of chapter 6. This Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. It's kind of little dropped-in statements at the end of a number of the stories to say that because God rules, those who side with him will rule too. Not necessarily now. Christians will continue to be trodden on. God's people are in chains in this book, in our world, in this day. I think in one of the churches that I worked in, there was a guy in that church who worked for the town council. His job was to draw up contracts for council workers. And as he said to me, many of the people that he was working as manager over were not blessed with the greatest intelligence. His job in the department he was in was to draw up contracts for lowly, low-paid council workers and deliberately hide in the small print of the contract employment loopholes so that the council would easily be able to sack council employees if they wanted to. And it was all hidden in legalese language so that the council employees wouldn't notice it. He decided as a Christian he couldn't do that, and so he was, quote, moved sideways. His wife is not a Christian, and you can imagine the conversation that went on at home. You did what? What? So in this world, there is no guarantee that Christians will do well. But in the last verses of these chapters, there are hints that, looking ahead to the future world, where things will be put to rights and God's people will turn out to be the winning side then. And little kind of previews of this, sort of this is the one to watch, this guy. They're going to be the cup winners. They're going to be the battle victors. They're going to be the forever prosperous, blessed super kids. And that is why this stand of Daniel and his three friends, that is what is significant here. This refusal that they have to eat royal food and wine, because this is the point where they show whose side that they are on. They're on, like that guy I just mentioned. The point to stand up and be counted. The point to nail their colours to the mast. The point to go public, to say courageously, brazenly, but humbly that they're throwing in their lot with the ruler with a capital R, and they're not just going to dance to the music of the King of Babylon's tune. They're saying that they serve a higher king. Look down to verse 8. Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Therefore he asked the chief of eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. And the key word in that verse is the word defile. For Daniel and his friends to eat from the banquet, the king's table, would be to defile himself. Now, the message is not here, be a vegetarian. Because it's clear elsewhere in the story that Daniel did eat rich food and wine. Nor is it that this is about Jewish kosher laws. You know, that's why they said no to the meat. If it was about Jewish kosher laws, there's no reason why they should refuse the wine. But it's the food and the wine. And it probably isn't anything to do with the fact that the food would have been closely associated with idol worship. Because actually, when you think about it, their names were even more closely associated with idol worship, and they were happy to take those on. I wonder if it's that this food is more like a business lunch. You know, the kind of lunch where the food is all about the relationship. It's about buttering up the client. And in the ancient Near East, that was the way to cement a deal, an agreement. You shared a meal together, a bit like it is in the city today. You know, there's no such thing as a free lunch. There's always things attached to it. And to eat food here from the king's table would be a sign of total dependence on the king, of total loyalty to him. It would be like saying, we need him for food, we need him for everything. We're going to be loyal to him as our ultimate provider. And as far as Daniel was concerned, this is the point that he said no. This is the moment for the citizens of Jerusalem to make it clear that there were limits to their loyalty to Babylon. That they belonged in Jerusalem, although they were currently in Babylon. So they would say yes over education, over a political career, over new names with pagan associations. But this was the point to say no. Some people have suggested that verse 7 and verse 8 should go very closely together, because both verse 7 and verse 8 uses the word set upon them. So in verse 7, the chief of the eunuchs tried to set upon these guys new names, kind of like giving them tattoos of the Babylonian gods, and marking them, branding them, setting upon them an anti-god identity. And in verse 8, that was the point at which Daniel and his pals set it upon their hearts a greater loyalty to the Lord. In other words, maybe that was the point at which they said, no, this is as far as we're going to go. For that is the point here, isn't it? They would say no to total loyalty because their loyalty to God mattered more. Now, here's the thing. The further away God feels, the more distant God feels, the more you feel that God isn't being good to you, the more you feel that his promises are in tatters, the more you feel that he's not actually ruling because everything around you in Babylon is so big and so real, at that point when it's kind of out of sight, out of mind, that is the point where they are most likely to cave in. So this is a remarkable moment, because despite all those things that seem to say God doesn't rule, they said, no, we will stand for the God who does rule. To him, we express our higher loyalty. If we belong to God, there is the point to say no to food from the king's table. And actually, you know how the story goes on. You know the story that's going to come a couple of chapters later of Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego. If they hadn't said no here to food from the king's table, do you think that in their middle age they would have said no when they're expected to fall down in front of an idol? You know the story of Daniel that's going to come a few chapters later. Do you think if Daniel hadn't learned to say no here as an undergraduate, to say no as a young man, he's probably in his late teens at this point, if he hadn't learned to say no here, could he have made the stand as an 80-plus year old man? 80-plus he was in the Lion's Den story. Could he have made the stand then, the stand that led him to the Lion's Den, if he didn't now, at this point, say no to the king's food? All kinds of people may claim allegiance from us as a rival lord, to our God who rules. All kinds of people expect that if they play the music, we will dance to their tune. Could be team spirit. Could be company loyalty. It could be big formal institutions, whatever that might be in your life. Babylon is full of people who expect these kind of things. There is a point to say no. Now, this isn't a charter for, you know, any kind of civil disobedience, fine, whatever is the latest trendy protest, and you know, camp out at St. Paul's or whatever, protest against capitalism or anything else you can think of. This is a religious issue here. That word in verse 8, defile, is key here. This is to do with arrogant anti-godness. And the point at which we graciously but boldly make the stand and we say here and no further. My first loyalty is to God, and you need to know that. Here and now, I will nail my colours to the mast and say I am a Christian. This culture and all it stands for is not my home. Babylon is not my home. I have a higher home that I am living for. A home that I'm living, that I'm heading towards. I have a God who rules, to whom I will be loyal. And that means saying no to you. So, when it comes to the EU issue and all the debates there are now about national self-interest, there may come a point where we have to stand up and say no to the relentless pursuit of national self-interest. That isn't the be-all and end-all. Actually, there is a loyalty that means more to me than national self-interest. We may want to hesitate before we sing, I vow to thee, my country, all earthly things above, entire and whole and perfect, the service of my love. That is idolatrous nationalism, isn't it? Patriotism. God rules above Britain. You might want to say, no, I won't sing that. I'm not making a party political point here, it's the same for whichever party is in government. The leaders of church denominations, there may be a point to say we respect you, we pray for you, we submit to your leadership, but there comes a point when we might need to say no to bishops and reports and synods as they drift further and further from what the Bible says. For God rules, not the general synod. Now, of course, I use those examples, and in many ways, making a stand against great public institutions would be much easier in some ways. But for all of us, for 95% of the time, saying no to food from the king's table is a lot more mundane, isn't it? It's much more like Daniel chapter 1. It's over something like food. A free lunch. It's not an obvious right or wrong issue. Maybe it's not an issue that we'd ever pick for a battleground. Daniel, where are you going to make your stand? Going to make our stand over venison stew. And Daniel 1 is tricky to apply. Because you think, why draw the line there? Why not draw the line there? What is it about that? And it is tricky. It's not straightforward. But please may I encourage you to do the hard thinking. Many of you are at the younger stage of your careers. Some of you may be students. You're relative junior workers in your field. As Daniel and his mates were here, learn now to make a stand. It won't be easier later. It'll be harder if you don't make the stand now. If you don't make the stand now, what makes you think you'll make a stand when you want to marry a non-Christian? When your career masters treat you like a slave and expect you to give everything to serve them? When prosperity sedates you and soothes you and rubs off all your clarity as a Christian, every edge of distinctiveness and smooths you down. And it may seem to be something quite small, as small seeming as what you'll eat, but there may come a point where you need to say no. So to say, in the science seminar, to put your hand up and say, no, I won't simply adopt all that accidentalism that your theories of origins assume. To say in your flat, your house share, whether you've got some non-Christians, where you want to keep it all happy, you want to avoid confrontation, you want to be nice, happy, doing a good Christian witness in this household, we've got to keep it all smooth. There may come a point where you say no to the lowest common denominator. There may be some point where you need to say, put your head above the parapet and say, I know this is going to risk it being all tickety-boo in our lovely little flat, but you need to know I have a higher loyalty than the happy feelings in our house or flat. In work, where everybody's intent on climbing the greasy pole, a point to make it clear that this greasy pole is not your number one priority. Thursday evening is RML. That's your higher loyalty. It might be something like that. No, I'm sorry. I made it clear right at the beginning. I can never stay late on Thursdays. In terms of a relationship, your loyalty to the boyfriend means that you will keep letting him bed you. And you need to say, no, I have a higher loyalty than you. To stand up and be counted now and say, we will not eat food that comes from the king's table because we have a higher loyalty to the God who rules. And it's in our daily life, that's when as God's people we must express that higher loyalty to the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. It's very easy to sing a song, Our God Reigns, You Reign, O Lord. Does he? How is that expressed in terms of your higher loyalty? The point where we refuse the king's food and politely put our hand up and say, God rules and I'm on his side. Daniel and his mates totally immersed themselves in this foreign culture. They took on significant leadership roles in Babylon, but all the time they made it clear that God rules. Yes, even when his people are in chains, even when a tyrant is in charge. And because God rules, we know that one day his people will too. And we side with him. I will tell the world that is the case. But you see that at various points today we're going to go into groups and talk about things. We're going to go and do that now. Why don't I pray as we go to those groups, and then I think Phil is going to tell us where those groups are meeting. Let me pray just at this moment. Lord God, you rule. You really do. You really are the king over every other king, and prime minister, and president, and nation, and tyrant, and bully, and terrorist, and boss. You are the one who rules. And Jerusalem is where we belong, with you forever. While we live here in Babylon, would you please help us to make it clear, very clear, that our first loyalty is to you. Please may we put all of our eggs in that basket. Not be worried to say so. Not be hesitant to say so. Not to be rude in saying it, but to say it clearly. To draw a line. And to make it clear to ourselves, to our friends, to people around us. We belong to you, and we don't mind who knows that. Help us now as we think some of these things through in our groups. Please may this increase our understanding of what you are saying to us this morning. In Jesus' name, amen.